Anthony Wright, good morning.
Morning, Howard. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, it is slightly soft, but I can hear you. Let's just start taking a look at some of the stories that we are dealing with. Iran has claimed that there is no military presence in Syria, aside from consultants. When I read the story, I thought, well, there's certainly no military left after Israel's attack on the weekend. But what they're saying is, in fact, that they're only military consultants. Potato, potato, Anthony?
Well, I think that this is an attempt by Iran just really to try and gain some face after Israel has taken down effectively its policy of ambiguity about attacks that it has been carrying out against Syria and against Iranian targets in Syria in particular. We spoke a little bit about this yesterday, that there is some disagreement still within the Israeli government as to whether this policy of ambiguity is the right one or not. But there seems to be little doubt that now that the Israeli government has gone down the route of admitting quite openly that it has carried out what it terms thousands of attacks against Iranian targets in Syria, that this has really offended the Iranians in some sort of way. And so they've been forced to defend themselves by saying that Israel's statements that it has attacked thousands of targets in Syria is just an attempt somehow to justify the failures of Israel in the region and to try to hide away the fact that it has been singularly unsuccessful in carrying out its attempt to attack targets in Syria. And so this is really kind of a public relations game, I think, that's being played now between Iran and Israel about all the events in Syria. I think it would be very safe to assume that its claim that only consultants are based in Syria is really misleading. We know that Iran has got substantial presence in Syria, military presence. It has soldiers. It has huge quantities of arms and ammunition that it's transporting via Syria to Hezbollah, to the Syrian regime, to its own staff, to its own military personnel in Syria. And in fact, you know, just to make a joke out of the whole thing, we do recall that Iran has actually admitted that some of its soldiers have been killed in previous attacks that have been carried out by Israel. So really, this is just a public relations game that's being played, which clearly has no base from the Iranian side.
But Anthony, why would they even bother? I mean, why would you bother to make a statement that is so patently obvious and so patently a lie?
Well, this has been a characteristic of the regimes in the Middle East for the longest time, where, you know, the regimes have just denied things which are so patently, clearly not correct. Mm. And they seem to have absolutely no embarrassment and no shame at all to making statements like this. And I think that a lot of it is to do with pandering to their own population, to their own community, to their own audience, because the people within their own country don't necessarily see it in the same way as we do. And they often believe all the lies and all the patently obvious denials that are so incorrect and so obviously not true. Mm. And yet, because they don't have access to the same information as we do, or perhaps they do, but they just don't read it. I'm not quite sure exactly why that is. But their own audience seem to believe a lot of the stuff that they come up with.
You know, it reminds me, I'll never forget having a conversation with somebody some years ago, and a South African guy, and he was saying he was up in Angola on behalf of the South African Defence Force, and they were listening to South African radio, and Pip Buerta was on the radio, and he said unequivocally, South Africa is not in Angola. We have no troops in Angola. And here was a guy from the South African Defence Force sitting and listening to that broadcast in Angola.
And you would be surprised how many people would believe that. Yeah, you know, and once again, it's all about really which is the audience that these remarks are being addressed to. Now, I suspect that this is all about for the Iranian regime, trying to enhance their position within Iran itself. And so the question is, do the supporters of the Ayatollah regime in Iran believe this stuff? And if they do, then the Iranian regime have effectively achieved their objective of you know, trying to reinforce their position with their own supporters and their own audience.
Absolutely fascinating.
I don't think anybody outside of Iran would honestly believe that.
I'm pretty sure that most Iranians wouldn't either. Anton, I want to move on to a very perplexing story. And of course, we read about the story that there was this murder of an elderly Israeli couple. They were found in their apartment in Jerusalem. But now it seems like police are beginning to think that this might have been a terror attack, a very, very different type of scenario from any other form of terror that we've seen taking place in Israel.
So I think that that's the key point. The bodies of Yehuda, not the bodies actually, Yehuda and Tamar Kaduri were found unconscious in their apartment in the Armon HaNetziv neighborhood on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And by all that, I mean, there was clearly evidence of violence that had been perpetrated against them. The modus operandi was obviously that someone had come and attacked them in their apartment. Now, this is not something that we've seen from terrorists in the past. And the first thoughts of police did not go towards the idea that this might be a terrorist attack. And yet, as time has gone by now, and a few days have passed, they've had an opportunity to rethink things and to try to piece together the moments that happened before that couple was found unconsciously and ultimately, unfortunately, died as a result of their injuries. It's now dawning on the police that this may well be what they're calling an attack out of nationalism. Motives, and this may well be an act of terror that's been carried out in the homes of those individuals. Now, the piece of the puzzle that tries to somehow links all of this together is the fact that last week, and I remember you reported this live on the air as it was breaking news during the time that we were talking, that 15-year-old Hadar Bezalel was actually attacked and stabbed in the Armon HaNetziv neighborhood on that morning. I think it might have been Wednesday or Thursday morning. Mm-hmm. She was attacked. Fortunately, not badly injured, and she's managed to recover from her wounds. But this is a piece that seems to somehow be linking the murder of the Kaduri couple now with Hadar Bezalel. And this, you know, the police are now saying, in the absence of any other motive for this horrendous murder that has been carried out in their own apartment, the police are now going towards the idea that this might well have been a terror attack that was carried out in their own apartment, an opportunistic attack. I'm not exactly sure what would have led the terrorists to actually enter that apartment and attack this elderly couple, but I think we're going to hear a lot more about this story, as indeed we unfortunately do about other terror attacks. But I think that this is now a real change in the way that this game is being played. And I think that this is really very concerning for many people who felt that at least while you were in your own home, that you had an element of safety. And yet, that may not be the case. The irony, of course, is that Tamar Kaduri had actually been involved in not one but two prior terror attacks before she was ultimately murdered. And so, you know, this is really a case, unfortunately, of an elderly couple who seemed to be doing absolutely no harm, going about their own business in their own apartment, and yet being attacked by terrorists. So I think that this is something that's concerning the Israeli security establishment a great deal, and that a lot of work is now going to go in to trying to understand a little bit more about that attack and what would have motivated a terrorist to actually enter the apartment.
Very, very concerning, because as you say, if it is a shift in the modus operandi, and it does mean that these types of attacks could take place in people's homes, well, that is a significant shift, and obviously one that is very, very concerning. The final topic that I wanted to discuss with you this morning, and in fact we wanted to make a little bit more time yesterday and we didn't, is Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah suffering from poor health? Obviously we know that there are strong rumors about it. We spoke to the Clarion Project as well yesterday, and they said it certainly indicates it, but there doesn't seem to be a very, very specific confirmation of that effect, to that effect. If this is the case, and I think we assume that it is, how does this affect Israel's leadership?
Well, there have been a lot of rumors surrounding Hassan Nasrallah's health. By the way, the thing that surprised me when reading the story more than anything else was the fact that Hassan Nasrallah is only, and I say only, he's only 58 years old. Okay, now when when I have pictures of him, you know, we see pictures from time to time, he definitely doesn't look like somebody who is 58 years old.
He looks like he's 140.
Yeah, he's certainly with a grey beard and all the rest of it. It looks very much like he's a lot older. I don't know about 140, but I would have certainly given him an extra 15 or 20 years. Yeah, I would have given him an extra 15 or 20 years at least. He's only 58 years old. The story is that he actually suffered from a heart attack last week and that he was hospitalized in Damascus. In Beirut, not in Damascus, in Beirut, in Lebanon. Now, the Iranians have come out denying this, saying that Israel is simply spreading rumors about Nasrallah's health and that this is really just a tactic on the part of the Israelis. But another part of the story is that there are very, very strong rumors that he's actually been suffering from cancer for quite a long time. Now, we do know that Nasrallah hasn't been seen in public for quite a number of months already, and that is not necessarily unusual, because one of the things that Israel does like about Nasrallah being there is that he is very afraid to come out in public, because he's afraid that Israel might well attack him. I would suggest that if Israel had wanted to attack him, that they would find him, even wherever he is hiding away.
Sure.
But that being the case, he has been very, very scarce in the public arena. And in recent times, that has not changed. But now people are saying that he's even been more scarce than usual, and that from time to time in the past, he's come out and made public addresses, something that he hasn't done recently at all. And so people are coming to the conclusion, at least some people in the know are saying, that this is because of his poor health, and that he's really unable to come out in the public area. And he hasn't been seen for at least 2 months, which is considered to be, you know, longer than usual. Now I think Israel is really beginning to think about what may happen in a post-Nasrallah era, and who the new leader of Hezbollah might be, and whether Israel might be able to scare him to the same extent as it has succeeded in scaring Nasrallah not to come out and make public appearances. I think that that's been very helpful in weakening Hezbollah to some degree, because one of the things about these organizations is that their public presence is very motivating for those followers who wish to carry out attacks against Israel. And the fact that Nasrallah has been forced to lie low is something which has been helpful in keeping the motivation of Hezbollah as low as possible. So we will have to follow this a little bit further to see how that goes.
Absolutely fascinating. It's just about to go 8 o'clock, Anthony Wright. Thank you as always for your insight, and we'll catch you same time, same place tomorrow.